This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas. It's time for Radio Cows, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, chewing the fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocows@cows.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the Cows Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio Cows, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio Cows. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cows.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Primary Sources, a service of the Central Arkansas Library System. I am, once again, Matt DeCampbell, and our guest this time is Jeff Nichols. Little Rock born and bred, local boy makes good, who's now a big-time writer-director in the movie industry and is graceful enough to be in town and to give us some of his time. So thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So talk a little bit about growing up in Little Rock, what it was like for you, and at what point did you start realizing that movies were going to be part of your life?
You know, I love Little Rock. And I love Arkansas by extension, but, you know, my parents grew up here in a small town called Altimer, which is just outside of Pine Bluff, about an hour southeast of Little Rock. And I had a really, you know, beautiful childhood. I was a suburb kid in Little Rock and had access to movie theaters and the amenities of a city, but then I would spend summers, you know, going to Altimer and visiting with my grandparents. So I got this really great combination of regular, normal American kid 80s suburb life and very rural, Arkansas farm life. My grandfather was a propane truck driver. And certainly, you know, this answer is given with hindsight. But that balance between getting to visit rural life but not be trapped in it or live in it, you know, I really grew to love that part of the state, even just aesthetically. But then growing up, you know, my dad owned a furniture store here for a long time. It started as a piano store with my uncle. And, you know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. I have two older brothers. And it was just a really great life. And my dad, you know, he, for whatever reason, I don't know, he didn't have a huge social set of friends or anything else. We didn't hunt. We really didn't fish. We just went to movies. I was in first grade, and he took me to see Pale Rider by Clint Eastwood, which is definitely not appropriate for a six-year-old. And I remember Clint Eastwood's character shoots everyone in the forehead. That didn't bother me at all, but there was a scene where I think a girl's dog gets trampled in a stampede, and I cried. I cried for half the movie. But we didn't leave, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's how my dad and I's relationship really, you know, took root growing up. But it's also how my love for films would kind of take hold. At the end of them, you know, we were like Siskel and Ebert. We would debate the pros and cons of every film. And I remember distinctly being able to open the paper and look at the movie show times, and I would have seen everything sometimes twice. You know, that's how frequent we did this. And so that's, I think, really where, you know, a love for films and cinema started, even though it was definitely from, you know, the multiplex kind of point of view. It wasn't until high school that independent cinema started to bleed its way into, you know, parts of Arkansas and parts of my consciousness, more importantly. And you have films like Pulp Fiction hitting, you know, Park Plaza Mall. And that starts to really, you know, evolve my understanding and knowledge of what film could be. But also, I always liked writing, you know. I was a late bloomer when it came to reading, but I always liked writing stories. And it seemed like in 1997, when I graduated from high school, film school just was kind of a cool idea. I had no concept of what it entailed. I'd never been on a film set, but it sounded like a cool thing. And I was a fair student, you know. I was a B student. I think my teachers liked me pretty well, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't blowing out the SAT or ACT or anything like that. And so, I don't know, film school felt like an appropriate place for me.
Did you get any opportunity when you were at Central to do any kind of student video work or anything to kind of develop that talent, or
no,
even
not
in
really.
Your spare time, or
you know, at Horace Mann, once they asked me to like film a football game, and I was so bad at it that they never called me again. no, you know, I was in, you know, my real connection kind of to the art scene in Little Rock started when I was in third grade. I think it was third grade. I auditioned for a part in a children's theater play at the Arkansas Arts Center. I think the first one I was in was Lord of the Flies, which was insane. Like, they built a giant mountain on stage, and we all ran around in our underwear. It was weird, but it was good, and that really changed my life. I worked at the Arts Center. I would do a play or two a year, mm-hmm. like up through seventh or eighth grade. Then I started playing basketball, and I kind of, you know, left that. But it made a huge impact on me. Being around other kids that were acting, but also, you know, the adults that would come through and act in those. And again, this is all judged with hindsight, but I have to think that had a big, you know, formative part of me being open to a career in the arts, me being open to attempting a career in the arts. But there was really no video stuff.
So we talked about that unusual combination of inspiration of Pale Rider and Lord of the Flies. But as a kid of the 80s, you know, what were the movies that you were chasing down on VHS to watch over and over and just having so much fun with?
Well, I mean, you know, you being a suburb kid, you grew up on whatever was in the theater, really. I remember being struck by, and I try when I answer this question, I try to be as honest as I can, because mm-hmm. you want to sound cool as a filmmaker when you answer this question.
Of course.
But in reality, you know, like the things that are lodged in my mind are a snow day in fourth grade, and my parents, for some ungodly reason, let us watch on VHS RoboCop. And when that guy comes out of that, you know, being dumped in acid and then hit by a car and explodes, like that kind of changed my life.
That's in a lot of ways. Formative experience.
but you know, I also remember every weekend it seemed like Cool Hand Luke was on TV, which you don't really appreciate at the time. You're like, this is an old movie that my dad watches,
right?
But I'm going to sit here and like, no man can eat 50 eggs. And then at some point you turn back, and that has become, you know, that's in my top five of like most important films yeah. of my life. Same with, you know, John Wayne. My dad was a big John Wayne fan, and I remember the first, because I wanted to please him, you know, you want to please your father, and I wanted to watch a John Wayne Western. And again, for some ungodly reason, he started me on The Cowboys, which is the only John Wayne Western where he's killed.
Where he dies.
By Bruce Dern. Yeah, that scar. I'm just explaining moments that I was scarred.
It's turning into therapy more.
Exactly. But no, you know, the magic of cinema of the 80s is Spielberg. You can't not yeah. talk about him. And, you know, we had Cinema 150 here in town, which I cry a little bit every day when I realize it's just, I think, a parking lot now. But that was a big, beautiful dome theater. And, you know, I got to see, you know, I was born in 78, so I missed Star Wars. But I was there for, you know, Empire Strikes Back. I remember distinctly walking in and seeing a lightsaber fight, and Return of the Jedi, the Indiana Jones films. That's also the theater where I think it was around in sixth grade, they did a reissue of Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh,
and it was an insanely beautiful film print. And that kind of changed my life a little bit. But they're weird things too. You know, that's what's so great. I remember distinctly going to Breckenridge Movie Theater and watching A Perfect World by Clint Eastwood, which turned out to be a really formative film for me to this day. In fact, I think 2 weeks ago, I just ordered the soundtrack on CD because you can't download it because I wanted it so badly. You know, it was really kind of a hodgepodge of things. I remember also at Breckenridge, I saw Bottle Rocket, you know, Wes Anderson's first film. Right. And I remember thinking like, okay, there's something else going on here. I also remember seeing The Big Lebowski there. This is in the old Breckenridge Theater before they put it in the parking lot. And the, you know, I remember falling asleep in The Big Lebowski and being like, ah, I don't get it. And then in college, returning to it and watching it 50,000 times and realizing, okay, this I need to be paying more attention, you know. I think I saw Raising Arizona at Cinema 150. So, you know, I got it all.
Yeah.
I watched it all and I kind of loved it all. To this day, whenever anybody asks me my top 10 films, I try to always include Fletch. But that's also partly because we had two DVDs in college with no cable, and one was Fletch and one was Goodfellas. But I do think both of those films are masterworks.
So when you get to film school, and I guess what did you walk in the door thinking you were going to do? And then what did you end up doing?
Yeah, you know, again, I didn't really know, but I could I'll tell you this. I'll answer it this way. I was surprised by how technical it was. I think it very quickly, you know, the comet fell to Earth and it was like, oh, this is work. And you have to like meticulously set up each of these shots. Like that seems like so much trouble. Like it feels so effortless when I watch it. How could it be so laborious to make? And I think the craft of it is really what I was struck by. The good news is, because I'm decidedly not a genius, it felt like something I could learn. You know, I was lucky enough to work on a documentary that a professor of mine made about Larry Brown, the writer out of Oxford, Mississippi. And when I heard him speak about writing, I often apply that to my thinking of directing, at least. Maybe writing, mm-hmm. but I think more talent comes into play when it comes to writing. But I'll explain that later. But he always talked about writing as something that you learn. And he was like, you could read my initial stuff and know that I was not talented. And I taught myself. I did the work. And that kind of journeyman attitude is something that seems like you could apply it to a lot of aspects of filmmaking. Going to North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, it was an undergraduate program that really, it was bizarre that it existed, but they treated it like a school for plumbers or something. Like you walk in and they teach you how to fold and put up a C-stand and wrap stingers or extension cords. And they basically, in your first year, they were like, if you drop out or we kick you out, you can still go to a film set and get a job. And so those kind of practical mechanics were, because I'm not that guy, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm not very, I don't do construction.
Yeah,
I don't,
you know, not that, very handy.
That's not me. But you know, those basic trade skills I started to pick up on. But then there were other things like I wrote my first screenplay ever my first year because we had to do a 5-minute video at the end of our first year on stage in one room. Those were the parameters. And I remember writing the scene, and there was an RA on my hall who was an older screenwriter. His name was Sean Harwell. He turned out to be a really accomplished screenwriter. He's written on a lot of TV shows and movies. And he was like, he looked at it and he goes, you know, this is just, you've just written dialogue, because I just would write the character's name and something with no description. He was like, you need to talk about like where they are and how they're moving. And it seems like such a, you know, simple idea,
yeah.
But it really kind of blew my mind. And I was like, oh, wait, like this is what, because I hadn't read another screenplay. I hadn't seen one.
Sure.
You know, I'm sure I glanced at one, but like.
You were just writing stories and then attaching the character's name to each line of it.
Pretty much. Yeah. I was just writing dialogue. And, yeah. And it really, I went back in and I started to write how they moved around the room, where they were sitting, what they were sitting on, and those details, and most importantly, that their body language and their movement really started to become the defining thing of the scene. because I had it in my head anyway. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know I was supposed to put it down on paper. And also it began this great struggle for me as a screenwriter, which is the balance between directing on the page and how to write out specific shots that I see in my mind. Because I do. I dream these things up like puzzle pieces, and I can see the camera movement and everything else. But as a screenplay, along the way, I decided that I just really loathed camera direction in a screenplay. A lot of screenplays you read, and the writer is like, the camera does this, and it moves this way. And I just felt like, in a weird way, as a director, like, don't tell me where to move the camera. Like, I'll decide where to move the camera. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you need to be directing on the page. You need to know what the point of view of the scene is and where these shots are going to go. So this kind of translation that happens from my brain of these images into how that's written on the page. So instead of saying the camera does this, I started forcing myself to say the character's doing this. And if it's about something the character's doing with their hands, you realize that's a shot of their hands, mm-hmm. you know, and there are ways to do it that that separate you from just trying to basically write out a shot list to actually figuring out, why do you want that shot? Like, what's the purpose of it? What's the point of view of it? And in a way, that started me down the path of I think actually becoming a director.
And so, when you're talking about this one scene that you had to do for the project, at what point of film school was that?
So that was my first year.
Okay.
And by the end, you know, we shot it. We were on a trimester system, and we shot it in the third, you know, trimester.
Yeah, this wasn't something you were learning like on your way out as you were about to emerge into the world. This was early.
No, this was first year,
yeah.
You know, and then second year I built on it. So like, it was a really cool program. When I got there, they had just graduated their first class. So the school was only 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
And they really didn't know what to do yet. They were still figuring out their curriculum. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing they had decided was, we're going to give these kids cameras and hope they don't kill themselves or anyone else. And so there was this freedom that I experienced there that started to get kind of ratcheted down by the time I was leaving. But you got to make stuff. You know, when I was looking at undergraduate film programs at other places, it was 2 years of theory, and maybe in your third year you get to pick up a camera. And really, it just was a primer for you to then go pay for graduate school. And
yeah.
Actually, then you do the real
stuff.
That's
when you really shoot.
And, you know, I come from a middle-class family. I wasn't going to be – I was impatient, you know. And that was good and bad for the film school. You know, the good part was we were producing – short films that were really technically proficient compared to other film schools, certainly compared to other undergraduate film schools. But the content was always somewhat marginal, you know, to be honest, my stuff included.
Yeah.
You know, because inevitably when you get younger kids, it's just hard to develop as a storyteller and have your own point of view. You know, when I came in, everybody was making rip-offs of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. When I left, everybody was ripping off Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's probably true of any film school, but it felt especially true of ours. And because you need more life experience, you need to just read more books, you know, I think in order to find your point of view as a storyteller, you know. But yeah, that school prepared me each year with actually making something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, in terms of writing and directing, you know, abilities, I was really confident. The thing I was missing, and I didn't know it at the time, was producing, like real world producing capabilities, which I had to go fill in the gaps after college with that.
And then at what point, I mean, if it was during film school and after you said you kind of started understanding what it was going to be like to be a director for you, at what point were you starting to finally put shotgun stories down on paper and starting to build it? Because I know it had been in your head for a while.
It had and it hadn't, actually. Mud had been in my head.
Okay.
Really since my sophomore year of college. A guy hiding out on an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. And it being Matthew McConaughey. That was 99, you know? Shotgun stories came around when I was living in Austin after college. So I made a senior thesis film called Noble Chrome Pirates that was kind of based on that Johnny Cash song, A Piece at a Time. Mm-hmm. And it was about a group of kind of rockabilly guys who are stealing car parts in order to build their dream car. And then once they get it built, then they start fighting over it, and it tears them apart. So they put it on train tracks and run it over. It was a good little short film. And the school would take us out to L.A. At the end of the year, if you were lucky, and show your short film in like a showcase to big Hollywood people. Right. I don't know who these people are, but they lived in Hollywood technically, and I think were probably very important. And I showed my film, and I got a bunch of meetings, and I remember thinking they were really important. And looking back on it now, they were probably like assistants of assistants that yeah. came out and gave me a card for something. And one of them was like, you should turn this into a feature film. And I was like, I will. And like, I'll have it to you in 4 months. And so I went back to Arkansas and lived with my folks, and I tried to write a feature screenplay of it. Pretty probably terrible. and I knew it was terrible. That assistant probably had been fired at that point. So, you know, I didn't even have any. And I knew it wasn't. I was kind of doing it because somebody told me to do it.
Sure.
You know? And so that's really when I pumped the brakes. I was working at US Pizza in Maumelle and living with my folks, drinking a fair amount of beer. And I sat down and I wrote my first real screenplay. It was called Blue Side, or Blue Side of Evening, based off of the title of a Steve Earle song. And it was good, man. Like, I haven't read it in 20 years, so
yeah.
I might change that opinion if I read it today. But it definitely started to feel like the point of view I wanted to explore as a storyteller and as a filmmaker. It was about a propane truck driver and Alzheimer.
Imagine that.
And I tried to submit it to the Sundance Labs, and it didn't get in. And I kept waiting around for someone to show up and help me produce this movie, because I had the directing skills, I had the writing skills, but I kind of needed somebody to show up and, you know,
build the production. Yeah.
And of course that wasn't going to happen. No, you know, shocker, nobody wanted to show up and produce this kid's first movie in Arkansas. So, you know, after a year, like, I was getting kind of depressed and like, oh no, you know, this thing's going off the rails a little bit. My brother had just started film school in Austin, and he started law school in Austin at UT, and I think he'd been there a year, and he was like, I don't know, you can come live with me. I heard it was a cool place. I was terrified of LA, didn't want to go to New York, you know, or terrified of New York and didn't want to go to LA, more appropriately. And so I went down to Austin, and immediately through a connection at my school, I met a woman who was kind of in the film business down there, and I took her out for a drink, and I had a Towns Van Zandt CD playing in my car. She was like, my friend's making a documentary about Towns. And I was like, I'll do anything. And so Margaret Brown was making Be Here to Love Me, this documentary about Towns Van Zandt, and she hired me as a PA. And that was a massive thing in my life for a lot of reasons. One, it was basically me and her hanging out in her house trying to get this documentary made over yeah. the course of a year. And I would do anything. I would take out the garbage and, you know, balance the checkbook. But also, you know, we would do these little mini shoots with Lee Daniel, who shot Dazed and Confused and Slacker, yeah. Great cinematographer out of Austin. And I would get to watch him work, and I would have to order film from Kodak, and I would have to talk to Photokim about the processing of it. And, you know, I was I'd started to learn Final Cut Pro, the editing software, because the year that I was here, I was directing furniture commercials for my dad. and they had gotten me a computer with Final Cut Pro, which I still owe them for. But that would be the computer that I edited Shotgun Stories on, so on that Final Cut Pro system. But anyway, that documentary really filled in the production gaps. Like, I would take, you know, they would build little mini budgets for these little shoots, and I would take those as templates, and those were the templates I used for the budgeting of Shotgun Stories. Those were the scheduling templates that I would use and everything else. So I was learning how to more or less produce a film. And after a year of that, I was ready to come home. I had been thinking about a film I could make. Margaret had given me a copy of Sam Shepard's book, The Motel Chronicles, and I thought that was a cool title, and I wanted to rip that title off. And I'd been thinking about a scene in a Larry Brown book, in Joe, actually, which was later turned into a movie by my friend David Gordon Green.
With Matthew McConaughey?
No, with Nicolas Cage and with Ty Sheridan.
Oh, right, right. Ty Sheridan.
Yeah. And there
Was it Killer Joe that was McConaughey? There was
Killer Joe
one.
Was
yes,
McConaughey.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
No. Okay. Joe is a book by Larry Brown, and there's a scene where he gets shot with a shotgun and has to pick buckshot out of his neck. And I remember thinking, what if a guy, when he was little, got shot with a shotgun, but they never took the buckshot out, and it just grew over in his back? And people told stories about how he got shot in the back, but nobody really knew if they were true or not. And that became Shotgun Story.
Well, and next time you're back in town, we can talk about, get more into Midnight Special and Loving and hopefully the smash hit of Alien Nation by then. But we have to talk before we sign off about the Arkansas Cinema Society.
Sure.
Which you are the driving force behind. We've now gotten through the premiere. And what do you see ahead now that it's on the ground and now that it's rolling? What do you want to see it become?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want to offend anybody. It's not that, like, I think Little Rock has a dearth of, you know, cultural activities. Quite the opposite, actually. I was just thinking about, like, what can I, as Jeff Nichols, contribute back to a place that has given me a lot? And I thought back to my time in Little Rock and how distant the film industry felt, you know, how not a part of it I felt. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a club that I wasn't ever going to be invited to. And I think had I been exposed to a few people that made films, that would have been a little different, you know? And now I know a lot of these people. I know a lot of filmmakers. I know a lot of actors. I know a lot of production designers and cinematographers and everything else, producers and editors. And I thought if we could not only have a screening series, but have a screening series that not every time, but throughout the year brings some of these people in, mm-hmm. it can demystify the process a little bit. Yeah. So I look out, you know, over the next couple of years, and I hope that the Arkansas Cinema Society is still up and running, and I see a network of theaters around the state that are willing to show our films. Mm-hmm. I would love to have a visiting guest artist that just doesn't come to Little Rock, but goes to Searcy or Pine Bluff or sure. wherever, yeah. you know? And so that you look up and you have a network of theaters that are showing films that they might not show otherwise. And you have a community of people starting to gather around that it's something cool. They're like, hey, yeah, the Cinema Society is doing something. Yeah. That's worth it. Yeah. We should go. Even if I don't show up or even if, you know, the filmmaker doesn't show up, that's a film I want to go think about and hang out with other people that are thinking about that film. That's the core goal. You know, we also want to start like a lecture series. I'm going to start in November with a series of writing for film. Then I'm hoping into next year I'll do one called Directing for Film and Editing for Film and bring other people in to do similar things. Yeah. I also would love to see a grant program started. And I have some strict opinions about those because I've seen good versions of that and bad versions.
Sure.
You know, but a grant program that might actually really help people just with those initial things. You know, we aren't looking to fund movies or anything like that, but the right amount of money at the right time or the right amount of support at the right time. As much as a grant system, I would love to have, you know, how amazing would it be to have Sarah Green and Brian Kavanaugh Jones and Sophia Lynn, my producer on Take Shelter, come in for a day and you sign up and you get to come talk to them about the movie you're trying to get up off the ground. And they'll tell you, here's some practical advice.
Right.
You know, I'm not here to tell you if your movie's good or bad or going to be successful. Like, it's not a pitch meeting.
Right.
It's like, well, have you hired a line producer? Do you know what a line producer
is?
You know, like that to me could be really useful. I hope it works out. You know, we're going to try our hardest to, and hopefully the community responds.
Well, anything you want to know about ACS and what's coming up in coming months, it will appear on ArkansasCinemaSociety.org. Of course, with this and many other podcasts and information about things like ACS, you can find on the Central Arkansas Library System's website at cals.org. Thanks for being here, Jeff. This has been great, and we could go a whole lot longer, but yeah. I know time is tight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thank you, everyone, for joining in and listening, and we will see you the next time around.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.